To order, the time is 1:40 on May the 7th. Present for the record, we have Representative Samuels, Anderson, Ogg, and myself, McGuire. On the agenda today, we have five items: HJR 26, HJR 20, House Bill number 145, HJR 4, and House Bill number 244. And it's my intent, I know Representative Anderson has to chair Labor and Commerce, but it's my intent to go up till 5 o'clock to try and get these things out. And so with that, we have HJR 26. And we have Bob Storer and Bob Bartholomew here to help the committee work through it. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of House Judiciary. I am Bob Storer. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Planning Corporation. To my left is Bob Bartholomew, who is the Chief Operating Officer of the Alaska Permanent Planning Corporation. What I'd like to speak to today is a proposed constitutional amendment to the Alaska Permanent Fund. After years, literally, of study by the Board of Trustees, the Board of Trustees have concluded that a change in the Constitution is in order to ensure that inflation proofing is in the Constitution so that all generations, from their perspective, are treated equally. From the first chair on, inflation proofing has been one of the key issues with the Alaska Permanent Fund. The way we propose to address inflation proofing is by limiting the amount that can be appropriated in any given year to no more than 5% of the moving average of the fund. We call that percentage of market value, or POMV. And what we are proposing is that that limit be based on the five-year moving average of the fund. What I'd like to do is speak to 5 points on the proposed constitution amendment versus the status quo, and then I'd like Bob Bartholomew to address the language itself, and we'd be happy to entertain questions as we go or at the end or however the chair wishes.
Great.
The key on the first step is the percentage of market value. I'm sorry, do you have, I'm going to go from this if you haven't.
We do. And so the members, Madam Secretary, were referring to a document entitled Five Key Differences Between the Status Quo and the Proposed Percent of Market Value. And the document has been prepared by the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation and is dated April 21st, 2003.
The percentage of market value, as I noted earlier, offers constitutional inflation proofing protection for the entire fund. The status quo on inflation proofing is by statute. It comes after the dividend, and it inflation proofs the principal only. To date, the legislature has always had the ability and has chosen to inflation proof this the fund, but that's not necessarily the case in the future. We're not predicting it. We just think memorializing that in the Constitution is a very important issue. The second item is that we do it by, as I noted earlier, it's a spending limit, no more than 5% of the five-year moving average of the fund. By limiting the availability of only taking the real income or the income in excess of inflation, the residual stays with the fund, and that's how you inflation proof, not taking all of the income from the fund, only the real income or the income in excess of inflation. As it stands today, the status quo, the entire earnings reserve may be appropriated. I can give you examples where over the last 4 years, up to 25% of the fund was represented by the earnings reserve. So one could appropriate 25% of the fund in the heady days of the bull market. Or there's been a couple times this year in the hopefully the late stages of a bear market where nothing was available. So think about that volatility. You can appropriate 25% or zero, depending on what happens. That's how it now stands. Markets are always volatile. You talk about during volatile markets, and I've been doing this for a long time, and I haven't seen it yet where there wasn't a volatile market. It's a magnitude issue, and we've been in very volatile markets. The POMV approach, or what we're suggesting, actually creates greater stability than the current methodology. We have had times where the dividend alone has been in excess of 5%, or over the next few years it'll be 3% or potentially zero, as I noted yesterday. There's still a 10% chance that there could be no dividend in the permanent fund this year. So you get greater stability and greater predictability by doing this methodology. Item four, I think this is important, is, you know, when the permanent fund was created 26, 27 years ago, it was a world of bonds only, and bonds are very stable. You buy them for income producing, you get the interest payment every year, and so basing your methodology as we do now on realized income or the cash, realized cash flow of the fund probably made a lot of sense, but that was a different world. Fund currently is comprised of about 50% in the equity markets. There, you buy more volatility on a year-to-year, but you earn a higher rate of return by accepting that volatility. And so the current methodology did make sense 26 years ago, but we think less so right now. We've spoken a lot about why 5%. We've stated that we believe the limit, if you will, 5% is on the high end of doable. It doesn't mean that one has to appropriate all the 5% in any given year, but we want to limit to up to 5%. But we've looked at 76 years of data. We know that our asset allocation and our statutes will allow us to achieve, we believe, a 5% real rate of return. Over time, we're very comfortable in making that statement. So it's consistent with our asset allocation and the long-term philosophy of a permanent fund. That stability really goes to predictability, and there is greater stability in the payout methodology of using a moving average of a fund versus the current one. Year to year, you don't know. We don't know how much would be available until, you know, the end of the day on June 30th. But if you accept our methodology as appropriate, you will have less volatility in the payout, and you will know with precision what is available in any given year. That, Madam Chair, is very briefly why we think moving to the constitutional amendment memorializing the spending limit is appropriate. I'd be happy to enter any questions or let Bob Bartholomew speak to the language.
Thank you very much, Mr. Storer. Anything to add, Mr. Bartholomew?
I think if the committee prefers, I was just going to take a couple minutes and walk through the actual changes to the Constitution.
That would be great.
Madam Chair, what I'd like to do is I'm just going to be looking at the actual CS for House Joint Resolution 26 that came out of the Ways and Means Committee. Q version.
I'm going to make a motion.
And I think this is actually the official version that came to this committee. So.
What is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we're
good. Thank you. So we're on the Q version, Ways and Means.
Correct. Now, just for a little bit of background, the Ways and Means Committee spent about 4 or 5 hours working on kind of the technical aspects of the language, and that involved legislative legal, Pam Cook, the outside counsel to the Permanent Fund, guidance from the Attorney General's office. So this language came out of a lot of work, and it was basically what all the involved parties felt was the best way to move forward. In the title, it's really just trying to make a statement of why we're amending the Constitution, and that we're basically want to limit the appropriations on a fiscal year basis that can come out of the permanent fund. And the reason we're limiting the appropriations is to assure the real value of the fund grows over time, and that all we're spending is the value in excess of inflation on a year-to-year basis, so you protect it. On page 1, line 10 is the First Amendment to the Constitution, and what that's doing is just referring to a new subparagraph B that we're going to add to the Constitution, and I'll talk to that on page 2. So line 10 is inserting the reference to a new paragraph in the Constitution. Line 11, we're deleting the word principle from the Constitution, and that's been something that's been a longstanding, that people have understood that the permanent fund, the principle could not be spent and the income could. The reason the trustees have proposed removing that, and that came after quite a lot of debate at the board meetings, is that the word principle, we believe you can protect the fund, as explained on page 2, by the spending limit. And the benefit of removing the word principle is basically a policy decision of balancing the benefit of assuring that each year there's going to be a distribution versus the risk that in the short term you might dip into the fund a little bit if you have a down years of income. So it's a balancing, and they believed it's in the best interest of the permanent fund and the investment strategy if we know on a year-to-year basis how much is going to come out of the fund and that it's limited and predictable, then that helps their investments. They know what to have invested. They know when they're going to have to raise money for the dividend or for general government. So that's a significant issue that's had a lot of debate. And then on lines 13 and 14, we're deleting the language from the Constitution that says all income from the permanent fund would go to the general fund except provided by law. And the legislature since 1982 has taken advantage of the provided by law, and they've directed that all earnings would go to the earnings reserve in the permanent fund. By deleting the two sentences, what in effect happens is all income stays in the permanent fund, subject to the 5% appropriation. So that it's no longer necessary to direct the income. On page 2 of the resolution, starting on line 2, is a fairly long sentence that does two things. It states how we intend to protect the permanent fund. You know, the goal is to protect the real value over time, and that it's going to be limited to a 5% annual appropriation of the 5-year average. But lines 5 and 6 are a little hard to read at first go, because it talks about we're going to use the market values on June 30th for the first 5 of the 6 fiscal years preceding the year that you want to spend the money. And the reason that language is in there is so that when the legislature comes into session in January, so an example this year, you've come into town, you're working on the FY04 budget, by looking back an extra year, it allows you to know on January exactly what's available from the permanent fund based on the spending limit. So you'll know as soon as you start working on the budget how much is available for either dividends or government purposes, and you don't have to ask for estimates, you don't have to ask for projections. So we're going to go back, and so what we'd be doing is the FY04 spending limit would have been based on year ended June 30, 2002, and that's the main intent was so you knew exactly what's available. It doesn't have to be appropriated, but there's certainty to the amount. And then the last addition is a temporary item, and that's Section 3, and that's a transitional item which won't become a permanent part of the Constitution. It just assures that at the date the voters pass this, that all the earnings of the permanent fund stay in the permanent fund. There's no debate about whether it's general fund money or other funds. It's part of the permanent fund to be protected. And then Section 4 states that this would have to go to a general election so that all the voters in Alaska could weigh in on this change, and that would happen in November 2004. And if that was successful, then it'd be approximately early January 2005 that the change would take effect. And so that I just wanted to walk through the changes. And again, happy to answer questions.
Okay, and I also wanted to note for the record that Representative Guerra and Gruenberg joined us some time ago. And we do have one person signed up to testify, and I want to just have you guys stay here, if that's okay, and get to this individual, and then come back before the committee for discussion. So I have Lori Churchill in the Kenai LIO. Lori, are you there?
Yes, ma'am, I'm here. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And I would just like to say that I am opposed to House Joint Resolution 26. The PFD's appropriations should not be limited. I believe the current funding formula should be left alone. Alaska is experiencing a decline in North Slope oil production. We're currently at 50% of what the North Slope used to produce in the 1980s. This decline in oil production means less money is being placed into the permanent fund dividend. I'm very concerned that the 23rd legislature has introduced 596 bills and resolutions, and out of these 596 resolutions and bills, 17 pieces of PFD legislation have been introduced. And in my personal opinion, only two of these bills are in favor of the citizens of Alaska. And I believe that SJR 19 and House Joint Resolution 3 are the only ones that favor the citizens of Alaska. And I'm just asking that you please vote no on this SJR, or I'm sorry, HJR 26.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Churchill, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else online that I've overlooked? Anybody else here in the audience that wants to testify on HJR 26? Okay, so I'm going to close public testimony, and that brings the CS back before us with the two Bobs and our discussion. So, Representative Kira.
Thank you. Got a series of questions. Let me just deal with one subject right now so other people can ask questions before I get to the next topic. The first issue has to do with the mechanics of this proposal. And under POMV, we'll end up taking 5% of the value of the permanent fund every year. I hope that a large part of that will go to a dividend, and but that'll be the subject of the next next comment. But how does this work? The concept is that we're going to keep the value of the permanent fund up with inflation. In addition, we're going to stick a certain percentage of our oil royalties into the permanent fund so it can grow and stay ahead of inflation. I understand that part. But tell me how the 5% payout will keep us up with inflation in, for example, a very high inflation year and a high earnings year. Let's say the stock market does really well. And then how it will do the same thing in a very low earnings year, terrible stock market, let's say the stock market loses money that year, and low inflation. So there are four factors that you'll face in the real world. Some years there will be high inflation. Some years there will be low inflation. Some years there will be great stock market and real estate asset returns. Some years there will be terrible stock market and real estate asset returns, maybe negative ones. Can you tell me what happens with the in relation to keeping the value of the fund up with inflation under those four different circumstances?
To the chair, Representative Guerra, it's a great question, and that is the basis of why the board and staff has spent a lot of time, and we recognize that in any given year or in short periods, that's a very real issue. If we looked over the last 3 years, we did not keep up with inflation in terms of the value of the fund. However, we did continue to inflation-proof the principal of the fund because of the discipline that's been invoked during the good years. In short periods of time, and I might define short as 3, even 5 years, you may not achieve the 5% real rate of return, or you will, if you were to look at 1998, you'd challenge why 5%. I don't remember exactly, but my guess is we probably earned 10 to 12% real rate return over the 3 to 5 years prior to that. It's the discipline and the longer term time horizon through the good and the bad times is what really matters. A lot of people focus on the bear market side of the equation and what happens in the down years. I think one of the importance of this is not getting caught up in what I will call the mania of a bull market and think you can overspend. It really is important to create that discipline in the good and bad times, and that will ensure the maintaining the purchasing power of over time for all generations. I give an example of at least one friend of mine who runs an endowment fund at a major university, and they got caught up in the bull market, and the university started a large capital project well in excess of what I'll call sort of theoretically the 5%. Now they're not able to sustain those kinds of returns, but they have commitments based on the heady bull market that they must continue to make and overpay. This creates the discipline in the good and bad years that allows you to achieve the goal. But in short periods of time, anything you suggested can happen where we could earn well in excess of 5% or well below that 5% real rate of return. If you think about it, it's only that long term. Any given year, there's so much volatility that one could not predict that kind of precision in even 1 to 3 year time horizon. Hopefully that answers your question.
Representative Guerra.
That deals with the issue of what happens if the stock market does well, what happens if the stock market does poorly.
Mm-hmm.
Probably answers the second part of the question, but I'd like a more specific answer on the second part of the question.
On the inflation?
Yeah, let's assume we have an 8% return in the stock market and on our real estate holdings in a particular year.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if, to the value of the permanent fund, if let's say inflation is 13% that year, and then what happens if inflation is 2% that year? Assume an average stock market and real estate asset return, but wildly varying inflation amounts for the year.
You're going to run into problems in the short term. Could I use a real life example, if I may? Let's go back to the late 70s, where inflation was quite high and continued higher, and in fact, I think I went to a conference in 92. It was one of the most depressing things I've ever seen because inflation, you know, in short-term rates were 22%. This was the beginning, not the end. So you wrap that emotion into it. And in fact, during probably the five-year period prior to that, you did have barely positive returns on bonds. And I think some absent 73, 74, you had positive returns on equities. But you were not keeping up with inflation. So we would not have kept up for probably about a 4 or 5 year period. And you'd say this isn't working. What happened around 82 is we were still in a high interest rate environment, and you keep fighting a war that you've won. In that case, inflation was descending and stayed low for what is now 15 years. We were just looking at our returns, and in the early 80s, there was 1 year where the permanent fund only had basically owned bond portfolio, and we returned 25%. And I don't remember, but my guess is inflation was below 6%. And so if you looked, even in that five-year period, if our asset allocation existed in that rising, horrible, high inflationary environment, we would not have achieved the goal. If you'd maintained that discipline, though, as we came out of that environment, and at least for 15 years and probably longer, inflation war was won, then I think we've achieved in excess of a 6% real rate of return ever since then. So in short periods, the answer, and I'm defining a short period in that case of 5 years, we would not have achieved inflation proofing. If you stayed the course and had that discipline, you would have been successful.
Representative
Garrett?
I'm done for now.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Compared to other large funds, Harvard or Stanford, I believe, their operations are run off of endowments. Do any of them operate the way ours do now, or for the most part, are they endowment-type scenarios?
Through the Chair, Representative Samuels, about 70% of endowments and foundations, we've looked at two studies. One is called by Greenwich Associates, and the other is NACUBO. And as long as you don't ask me what NACUBO stands for, I'm okay. But it's we found about 70% of endowment and foundations use some sort of payout methodology that is formula driven based on a percentage of market value. What I found is most use about a 3 year time horizon. Many use a five-year. The longer you're moving average, three versus five, the greater the stability from year to year, ultimately the payout is the same. And we have found that our payout methodology, what we're suggesting at 5% limit, is not inconsistent with that study as well. But I think more important on the spending side is not what others are doing, but it's consistent with what our asset allocation and our objectives are. But about 70% of endowments and foundations use a formula driven payout based on market value.
Jim Samuels?
A follow up also on the 5%. Actually, it will be less as the average goes. That's what I'm reading from the numbers.
To the chair, that is correct. What happens is you look at the payout two ways. It's 5% of a five-year moving average, and in a perfect world, the fund is growing every year, so that 5% is a series of five smaller and larger. Usually, they take the snapshot then based on the year-end value of the endpoint. And if you looked at that 5% payout and just assumed you earned 8 nominal, 5 real, it equates to more of a 4.6, 4.7 payout versus the ending value of that time period.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And if I may follow up, Bob pointed out that in the back of that PowerPoint is a schedule.
Yeah, the last page in that handout just shows you, again, going forward, if the permanent fund achieves its median 8% return, what's the true effective rate of taking 5% of a five-year average? And so it's really the 4.6 or the 4.7, 4.7% that Bob Storr indicated. So that just shows you the numbers.
Question also. The other 30% of the funds, not the 70%, the other 30%, do any of them operate the way that we do, where you have no idea day-to-day, year-to-year, what you're going to have in the earnings?
The chair, I can't, whether they're based on realized income such as we do, I do not know the answer, but some do shorter time horizons, and those are the ones that, in my opinion, this is an opinion, are suffering the bigger problems right now because they were living from day to day, but there are some that are used shorter time horizons, and Yale's formula would only be, only Yale could create a formula like they have. They're happy.
And they're probably fairly proud of it, too.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sure they are.
Okay. Representative Groenberg.
Thank you. Thank you. I've heard a lot of this bill. It's not that it's not worth hearing, but it's a very thoughtful piece of legislation. And there are many dimensions to it, as you were getting into with Representative Guerra. And there's been something that has bothered me, not bothered me in the sense of a negative, but bothered me in an intellectual sense that I couldn't quite articulate until now. A lot of people have said to me that this is a good piece of legislation because it adopts an endowment principle. And I wasn't able to accept that premise. Now I know why. And that's because all of the endowments that I'm aware of, and I'm going to use university-type endowments as an example, are different than the permanent fund in one key respect that you put your finger on when you were talking with Representative Guerra. Endowments, I'm going to use a typical endowment model. We received today a report from the University of Alaska. I don't know if you folks read it on the floor, but we got it in our mail today. Some people who've endowed a chair in economics, as it happens. And that's a fairly typical kind of an endowment. That endows what I would call an operating expense. Salaries are typical operating expenses. I'm not aware of endowments that endow both operating and capital, although there may be some, but I see a significant difference And it's highlighted by the model you were postulating with Representative Guerra. There were four different variables: high inflation, low inflation, good stock market, bad stock market. I would like to focus on the high inflation model and the fact that this is endowing capital expenditures as well as operating expenditures. I could foresee a circumstance, high inflation, where a legislature might say, we foresee a period of high inflation coming up. Therefore, what we want to do is buy our capital expenditures now, while we can do so relatively cheaply, because a road will cost a lot more next year, and more even than that the year after. So what we're going to do is put our money into assets that will float with the inflationary rate. And because you have a governor or a cap on the amount that can be appropriated in this bill, it has a weakness because it won't let the legislature deal with high inflationary rates by investing in a capital budget now. How do you answer that problem?
Chair, I think the one thing we have always said, and this is not to deflect your question, I'll answer that, but the one thing we've always said is our perspective is inflation-proofing and ensuring that all generations are treated equally. We've never said how the money, the trustees believe it is not within their providence on how the money is spent or appropriated, and so we've stayed away from that issue. There is a board of trustees. We have a charge of fiduciary responsibility is an important word, and it gets used, frankly, in a cavalier manner. I'm sorry. I was going to the asset allocation.
Not to interrupt, Madam Chair.
That's okay.
And you are deflecting, with all due respect, because we're not talking, A, about the way that the trustees are investing the fund monies, and we're not even talking about the trustees at all. We're talking about the legislature here. And obviously that's not within your purview, but it's definitely within ours. And I think for a constitutional amendment to work, we have to recognize and deal with that factual possibility.
That's fine. I think Bob Bartholomew.
Through the Chair, Representative Gruenberg. And I think, if I understand the question, you're posing would be a situation where the state legislature would believe it's in their best interest or the state's best interest to spend more in the short term.
On capital because of high inflation.
Correct, to spend capital. So that's, as you know, any time you're trying to set a policy, we're proposing a policy here that the number one priority is the protection of inflation. You have the flip side of that, where you need to spend additional money, and the legislature does have numerous tools, issuing debt, so you would cap the distribution from the permanent fund, but it could fund debt. If you wanted to issue debt to take advantage of needing a large amount of money, you would have a stream of money from the permanent fund that you could commit to debt retirement. So that's just an angle of where you could issue debt and say, for the next 5 years, I want to use X amount of the 5% to retire that debt. So that's just an example of where, at least knowing you have a steady stream, we're going to get, you know, we're not going to have any problems issuing debt. And I'm not saying you directly link them, but that's just an option.
Hey, Representative Ogg.
Madam Chair, I appreciate your, what is it, inside intuition probably. My question, I think, is just more towards the language here. When you write something to put into the Constitution, the language should be fairly clear and not ambiguous. And there's a couple of terms in here. Perhaps it's in Section B. I think that's one area that I'm concerned about. Section 8 basically indicates that we're going to put all the earnings and whatever else that we have coming to the permanent fund into it, and then we're going to function on what we take out. And Section B is the defining language as to how things come out of the permanent fund. That's my understanding anyway. And it's odd to me, and maybe I, not being a great constitutional scholar, that the first clause of B is sort of intent language. It's not mandatory language. And perhaps you could explain to me why a clause of the Constitution is just talking intentionally.
Question.
To the Chair, Representative Ogden, that was where those 5 hours in Ways and Means were spent. And I will just summarize that the discussion was, you could simplify the statement in subparagraph B by just strictly stating that you're going to limit appropriations to 5% of the five-year average with the look-back provision, and you would basically cut the sentence in half. And there was a strong amount of support to say, let's keep it very clean and very specific. And the other side of the discussion and the discussion that came from the Board of Trustees' recommendation was, since we're removing the word principal, and that's been something that has been there, people have understood that, they did talk about having a statement of intent of how are you going to protect the permanent fund. And so it is an explanatory or preface to the 5% spending limit that we're doing that. We're protecting the permanent fund against inflation over the long term, and then it leads into by a 5% spending limit. And there was discussion that it would work without that first half of that sentence. There was also discussion that there is precedence where the Constitution currently does have a policy statement in it. And it is truly a policy question or a question of what is the preference of the legislature.
And Mr. Bartholomew, wasn't there discussion about the fact that it's going to go before the voters as well?
Right. It was this. They were talking might help them.
Yeah. You're placing provisions on a ballot, and so while all of us here today are familiar with reading statutes and knowing what they do right away immediately, that having some kind of an intent language in there so that the voters know what it is, I think is helpful. Representative Ogg.
Yes. Well, and I was there for some of those discussions, not all of them. And I may have missed a little portion of it here or there. The clarity of the first clause is something. The intent is to protect from the effects of inflation, but not deflation. And then I guess I'd like to have a clearer understanding of how somebody who would argue these type of things before our Supreme Court would define such things as real value and then over the long term. I know these are terms of art in the accounting field or the investment field, but they're not terms of art so much in the legal field that I know of.
Through the Chair, Representative Ogg, there was a lot of discussion about not wanting to create this basically open field for legal challenges, and that this language may open up that opportunity. There is also going to be implementing statutory language for how should this constitutional amendment be implemented, and there has been House Bill 298 introduced to start that dialogue. And we've had some discussions, actually not with the House, but in the Senate, that they would use that implementing language to possibly look at how to define real value and long term, so that it was clear the legislature did make a statement of what they mean by those terms. So rather than you've got two choices in the Constitution, either leave it out or have it in, and then use the statutes to help clarify it versus making the Constitution longer. So if you deleted it, then you wouldn't have to address it in statutes. There is a feeling that if it's in there, you're not required to address it in statute, but that is where you may look at when does the legislature not take the full 5%. If you go through these periods, extended long periods of inflation, maybe you don't want to take 5%, and so you may want some criteria, and it's a very difficult area. And I'll just say again, for long term, what we've been testifying to is following kind of what the U.S. Treasury, the difference between a Treasury bill and a, correct me if I'm wrong, and a Treasury bond, when it becomes long term, is 10 years, a note in a bond, Treasury note. So we're looking at, it's really long term, we tend to follow that U.S. securities. 10 years is the period we're thinking you're looking at. And so, to the Chairman of Ogg, so there may be a benefit to addressing your concern in that implementing language and looking at House Bill 298 or whatever the appropriate vehicle would be.
Make me feel a little more comfortable. These terms, I didn't hear you say that these terms have some kind of legal meaning at the present time, that scholars or constitutional attorneys could say, I know what that means. You're saying to me that, gosh, we don't really know that, but at the present time, we're looking at long term. We think that that's sort of what we like. The one we like right now is the one that the U.S. Treasury uses, so we think that's it. What causes me concern is that today's legislature may define these terms in one sense, but as you know, one legislature will not be binding upon another legislature, and we may get another legislature that defines these terms in a different fashion. It's an interesting way to approach the Constitution. It's not a road I feel comfortable with.
Through the chair, Representative Ogg, I think there are financial and economic definitions for those terms. And when we're talking about the real value, we're talking about maintaining the purchasing power. So when they say real value, the standard understanding is a dollar today. In 10 years, we still want to be able to buy a dollar's worth of goods. So if inflation is 10% over that time, it's going to cost $1.10. In 10 years, we want to have saved enough of the earnings in the fund so that we still have the purchasing power for the $1.10. So when we're talking about real value of the fund and the reason we're talking about inflation, we want to cover the effects of inflation. So that is an economic term that's defined, and that's our intent here. And long term, we are talking, there could be debate, but we're recommending you're looking at a 10-year time frame. So we have some clarity, and I've done a good job of explaining it. But as the existing Constitution that we're looking at changing, it says, unless otherwise provided by law, it is usual in cases to not try to define everything in the Constitution because it gets long, like our statutes. So it's finding that balance. I think clarity and precision is important to the extent that you can achieve it. And so I think if there was a desire to clarify this language or shorten it, then, you know, we want to be amenable to doing that.
Madam Chair, just have one more question. If you were to apply that clause in a real-life scenario, let's say we had this particular thing in effect 3 years ago, and the fund had reached a value, which I think it did, of around $29 billion. What impact would that have on us today?
To the chair, Representative. I'm just sort of thinking back, and sort of my answer is more conceptual. I think we'd be about the same place. We went through a bull market where we were earning extraordinarily high real rates of return through about March of 2000, and then we started earning negative real rates of return because of the stock market. So the answer in what is long term, and I want to reinforce something you said, that is a term of art. I think it's sort of 10 years or longer is a decent benchmark. But if you were going to use that as your benchmark, I think what you go back over that 10 years, I'd be surprised. And I'm going to look it up when I get back. I'd be surprised if we didn't earn a 5% real rate return looking back over the last 10 years.
If I could just add one point to the chair involved, I think we do and can show that we have over the last 10 years earned in excess of the 5% real. And since for the last 3 or 5 years, we have not spent in any one year more than 5% of the market value of the fund. We'd be in the exact same position unless you would have spent more for any reason. But given how much we've spent, we never spent more than 5%. The legislature could have. That money was available in the current formulas. So if this had been put in place 5 years ago, I believe the financial position of the fund would be exactly where it's at today because we haven't spent more than 5% and we've earned more than 5%. So just a...
Madam Chair, one follow-up. My question was trying to focus not on so much the 5% part of spending it, but was on the words real value and long term and how they would apply in that particular situation. And real value, because you're running through a period of great growth. The fund itself increases in value to like $29 billion. Is that a real value anymore? And then it drops to where does real value fit in there at that point in time?
The chair, Representative Valk, I think if you look back, and I'm going to double check the math when I get back, but I'm comfortable saying we achieved that goal, that objective during that period. It was just slightly less than $29 million, so your memory is correct. I believe it was in March of 2000 when it I remember it quite well because I became the executive director in February 2000, so it's embedded in my mind that date. But the but the drop in value has been in three ways, really. One is paying out over $2 billion in dividends, and then another portion has been from subtracting from the earnings reserve to the principal. And yes, a good portion has been through the market drop as well. I think over the last... from that period, the first fiscal year period negative 3.25, second fiscal year negative 2.25, and I'm delighted to say we're slightly positive this fiscal year to date as of last night. it's been a while, and I got my fingers crossed as well. So the drop in value of the fund was not all due to the markets. In fact, we were able to inflation proof and meet the dividend distribution during that three-year period as well.
And to the chair, I add another point. When it reached $29 billion and the NASDAQ market had just finished a year of returning 80%, there was a lot of question of, was that real? And people that bought it at that time have learned it wasn't. And so the principal, what was protected against inflation back then was $21 billion. So we had $8 billion above principal, and I think the market has told us it wasn't all real. The $21 billion, luckily, is still real. If the market corrected another year, the value of the fund would go below that. And so there, real is trying to maintain that principal, or the purchasing power of that principal. So as we move forward, that's what's real to us, and we're going to have up years again. And the fund's going to grow, but it may grow faster than the sustainable markets, and they're going to come back down, or vice versa. It could go down and then up. So I guess that helps.
I don't know. I'm sorry. Nope. Madam Chair, just it begs more questions, and I really didn't want to go down a long road like this. But and that's the problem with real value. Real value here now seems to be, I'm hearing, well, it's tied to the NASDAQ, that would have been the real value. So whatever the real value of the NASDAQ is, that could be it. Or is it the real value as to the value of the economy of the state of Alaska, real estate, the cost of real estate? Clearly, $29 billion purchasing of real estate today it hasn't decreased in this state down to $23 billion. So that's I just have concerns, you know, like real value and long term. Now real value might be NASDAQ, or is it real estate, or is it the economy, or is it just, why confuse people, or why confuse lawyers with language like that, where
Chair,
we go down
think,
these different roads?
Sorry for interrupting. Excuse me. And what we're, when we talk about real value, it's the real value of the fund and maintaining the purchasing power. And we tend to define real value as the way it's defined right now, which is using a CPI or a consumer price index. It's a sort of standard inflationary index is the criteria for what we use for our guide for inflation, if that answers your question.
I see where Representative Ogg is going, and I know that that has been the sticking point, if you will. I was looking at the first draft of the bill, and it looks like you did have the term real value in there as well, preserved over time versus over the long term. Could probably debate that for another hour or two, but let's not.
Yes, Madam Chair, I don't wish to get down into a debate.
Just bring it up. Nope, I understand it. I mean, it is the kind of language that you typically see in a regular bill in the intent section, but it's difficult when you're putting something in the Constitution and you do have to present it to the people, to the voters as well. And of course you can, you know, put in the voter pamphlet all kinds of information, but when it comes down to that minute that you're looking at the actual language, and you see something that says may not exceed 5%, it seems to be a negative versus a positive. And so I think having that first part of the sentence in there allows you to understand what the purpose of that limit is. It's for the benefit overall, not to limit the size of your dividend. Representative Kara.
Thank you. Let's see. There's one line of comment I'll just save for an amendment I'm going to offer. I'll just save that for later. On the subject we've all been talking about, my big fear that we're going to do something to jeopardize the permanent fund. And I know that POMV is a careful attempt to not do that, but it still worries me. If there's one great decision we've ever made in the state, I believe it's the creation of the permanent fund. But I worry about some of these 10-year horizons, where to an economist, 10 years is a short amount of time. To legislators, to school children, 10 years is an incredibly meaningful part of their life. And so I'm worried that if we take 5% of the value of the permanent fund out every year, and we have one of these 15-year difficult periods for the stock market, though that's looked as a blip on the screen by economists, that's a whole generation of school children here. And I'm wondering whether it is wise to spend upwards of 5% of the value of the permanent fund when we might have a 15-year period of economic downturns. So I guess the first question is, can you tell me, I mean, I just have a general understanding, but how long have economic downturns, and I'm talking about economic downturns, which means stock market downturns or level periods, how long have some of these periods lasted in the past? What kind of periods are we facing where we might see declines in the value of the permanent fund, plus 5% withdrawals from the value of the permanent fund, in order for me to know how much we might possibly damage the permanent fund under a proposal like this? I guess I'd like to know what those time frames have been historically.
The Chair, Representative Guerra, I think the answer to me, just the first part, is that 5%. There are more up markets than down markets. That 5%, and I'm talking about the stock market here, which is really the driver of higher rates of return. And so that, in my mind, that 5%, and it's a limit. One does not have to take 5%. It is a limit, but it creates a discipline on the upside. There have been what I would, depending on how you want to define the depression, there are since sort of the modern era, most data goes back to 1926. You can go to 200 years, but people use 1926 as the benchmark. And depending on whether you want to break the depression into one or two parts, I'll break it into two. There are four significant downturns. The depression had a several-year downturn, and then the stock market went up 50%, and then it had a few more years of downturn, and then the stock market went up and with a few down years after that. After that, prior to what we're experiencing right now, the worst years were in 1973 and 1974, and nobody wanted to own stock in 1975. And you could say that was the beginning of this long run that we've just experienced. Now we have now, which has gone on for about 3 years, well, almost exactly 3 years, this bear market. I found that there were 14 observations where there was a negative year, and I apologize for throwing statistics at you, but I found there were 14 observations where there was a negative year followed by a positive year. The average rate of return when it turned positive was up 28%. That was with a high of 50%, and that was in the middle of the depression, to a low of up 4%. And I forget when that was. I think it may have been in the mid-70s. Typically, if you accept that data, and I do, is usually when you come out of the bear market, the stock market will go up rather dramatically because of the depressed prices in the stock market. I'm not prepared to suggest that will happen in this time, because we went to such a high bubble preceding this, or high valuation, that we're more back into normal valuation. So I'm not about to suggest that this market will turn around and we'll achieve a 28% or anything like that. Getting back to try to be succinct, four real periods of prolonged bear markets. Two periods where you could break it down were in the depression, when we were in a deflationary period. One was the precursor of the, it was in the middle of the oil crisis and commodity shortages and inflation and that guns and butter era of the Vietnam, at the end of the Vietnam War. And then the one we're going through right now, which was preceded by an extraordinary bull market. But most of the time, the stock markets have gone up.
Before you answer, let me just clarify the question. I didn't say it right. There have been periods of time where the stock market hits a peak.
Yes.
It goes down, and it doesn't reach that peak again for 5 years, 10 years, I think even sometimes longer than that. Those are the long periods of drought that I'm wondering about. What have been the longest periods of time where a stock market has hit its peak and then not reached that peak again, the longest period between those? Because that's the period I'm worried about, is we hit a high moment for the permanent fund.
Yes.
We're the legislators for the next 15 years. We're spending 5% of the value of the permanent fund in a long period where we never get back to the peak of the stock market.
The two periods that were prolonged, and I can't remember the years, but one was during the Depression, where I guess it was 1929 was a peak, and I don't believe, I'm going to go back and check that data because that's what I like doing anyway, but I think it was 10 or 15 years or maybe longer that we came back up to that era in terms of valuation of the stock market. The other, if I remember correctly, in the late 60s, and I'm going to pick either 66 or 68, the Dow hit 1,000. It may have taken 10 years for the Dow to hit 1,000 again. I'm offering extremes, but those extremes did happen. That is also, keep in mind, why we diversify our portfolios. The permanent fund is only about half invested in equities. Our bond portfolios and our real estate portfolios have been achieving double-digit returns during this last 3 years, and so that's why you don't want to get caught up in the mania, and the permanent fund did not, in terms of thinking you're supposed to put all your money in the stock market, and we've benefited from that in the bear market. While our returns have been negative, they've been considerably less than our peer group out there. We've been achieving very high comparative returns. So you want to diversify. Not that I've given you extreme examples, but diversify in a manner that helps you achieve your goals, both in your long-term objectives and your risk. That's a risk. We look at that modeling every day.
Okay, we've been at this for a little bit here. We've got, I want to get this bill moving along. It's part of an overall goal on the part of the majority to get a series of pieces into certain places. And so I'm going to get this bill out today. And I know that Representative Guerra has an amendment. And so, Representative Guerra, do you want to offer your amendment at this time? Is this the only amendment?
Yeah, that'll be the only amendment.
Okay. So we'll number it. Amendment number one.
Before I move amendment number one, as I look through it, I scratch this out and spell the number of words wrong. So,
do you want to make it conceptual so they can do a spell check?
So before I move the amendment, if I could just mention three mistakes.
Okay.
There's a line that begins or number two, 50% of the amount stated. I don't think we'd ever pay a permanent fund dividend that is 50% of the value of the permanent fund, because that would be a dividend of many millions of dollars. that is the Mackey plan.
Yeah.
Before the word 50%, I'd put in the words a per recipient share of.
A what?
A per recipient share of.
Get that, Madam Secretary?
Was that a little a in parens?
Yes.
Okay.
Then, going further down, I under subsection D, I misspelled conceptual and misspelled severability. So there.
Okay. So with those amendments.
I move amendment number one.
I object.
Okay. Let me. Amendment number one would constitutionalize the dividend. My worry is that if we adopt this constitutional amendment, it might be seen by some as a first step towards getting rid of the dividend itself. And so, if we're going to authorize the legislature to spend any of the permanent fund, I think this is the time to make sure that we enshrine the dividend in the Constitution as well. So this amendment enshrines the dividend in the Constitution, so the legislature can't get rid of the dividend program. It also sets a minimum amount to be paid for the dividend, so this vote will happen in November of 2004 if this resolution passes. I don't want the dividend to go down lower than the most recent dividend before the vote comes along. So the proposal is that the dividend shall never be any lower than the greater of the 2003 or 2004 dividend. The dividend shall never be lower than a per recipient share of half of the money that we take out of the permanent fund. And just so members of the committee know, I spoke to Bob Bartholomew. If projections work out well, it seems like by 2004 the dividend might be about $900. Seems this year, if we have a dividend, it might be about $1,100. If we pass this amendment and we split the use of this 5% 50-50 between state government and the dividend, at 50-50 in 2004, that would be something close to a $900 dividend. But so in that year, for example, under this proposal, the dividend would be higher. It would be no lower than the prior year's dividend. But the concept is that we should enshrine the dividend. We should make sure that it doesn't keep going down. And we should also give the legislature the flexibility to issue a larger dividend beyond that. But I want to set minimums. I'm just worried that we're going to start losing the dividend. The dividend, I think, does a very good job of sharing the wealth among Alaskans. There are very few programs anywhere that where people of all walks of life share in wealth, and I think it's become something that that our economy relies upon. I think I've seen numbers that show the drastic effects upon this economy if we were to take the dividend out of the economy. That's not to mention the obvious uses that many people use for the dividend, which is prescription drugs and payment of prescription drugs, payment for food and shelter and clothing. So That's the idea. There's a subsection D which addresses a legal issue. There is some argument back and forth that if we constitutionalize the dividend, that somehow the IRS might start taxing permanent fund earnings. I don't believe that that would happen. I've looked at the arguments myself. I'm not a scholar on the issue, though. And so what subsection D would do, and this is a conceptual part of this amendment, would include a severability clause that said if constitutionalizing the dividend caused the IRS to start taxing the permanent fund, then we would not go that route because we wouldn't want the permanent fund to be taxed. So that would make this section severable. And there have been previous versions of a POMV amendment that have included a severability clause, so that's just conceptual for now. But when the amendment passes, then we'll draft the amendment's language, as we'll need to do.
Well, I don't think we'll have to worry about that. Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would agree with a lot of what Representative Garrett said on the importance of the dividend in the economy, but I disagree with some of the other comments that were made, though. This doesn't authorize any more than now. We can go spend the earnings of the permanent fund, just take a vote, and away we go. That we can do that right now with 21 and 11. I think that we need to stick to the framework that the trustees have set out here and have as a separate issue what we do with the money. The intent of the trustees, and I believe that we should stick to the goal, is to set up a long-term framework, and what we choose to do with the money as a legislature, maybe we go 50% or 60 or 70, maybe we enshrine it in this, but it's a completely separate issue what we choose to do. Together, I think, muddies the water so badly that we're putting politics in place of something which is really an issue of fiscal stability, and I think we need to keep the politics out of it as much as we can, and it's already too late. And the minute you mention permanent fund, the politics swirls around, and you know, half of the people are, you know, then we start talking about income tax, sales tax, caps on the budget, and you cannot help swirl it, but this just makes it even worse. So as a separate issue, we as a legislature or a future legislature needs to certainly discuss this, because I agree the dividend is a very important part of the state and it's an important part of the economy, particularly those people in rural Alaska, more than in my district. But to muddy the waters right now, I think, does a disservice to the people of Alaska, because we need to get our house in order on how we're going to pay the bills, how we're going to talk about a dividend, who's going to pay, what they're going to pay for, and how they're going to get it. We need to come up with, I hate to say the word, but we need to come up with a plan and a process to get there. And I think this is detrimental because it is going to be more divisive than the bill without it. And I don't disagree with you, Representative Guerra, probably as much as you think that I do on some of these issues. But I think that if we're doing a disservice to the people of Alaska, we are it's a divide and conquer thing. And I'm uncomfortable putting the dividend in with this, which to me, you know, political suicide, here I go. I'm in favor of this as it is, because we can decide what we do with the money later. But if we start throwing the politics in at this early stage of the game, then I think that we're going to have a really ugly time 2 years from now when the money runs out.
Don't think Representative Samuels wants a yellow button. But I do want to commend you for not wearing that today. I thought you might.
What does the yellow button say? I don't have one.
You don't? Well, I won't give any free airtime to it. Any further comments? Okay, and so with that, my objection is maintained. And Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll?
Representative Ogg.
No.
Representative Holm is absent. Representative Samuels.
No.
Representative Guerra.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
No.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative McGuire.
No.
1-5.
So thank you, Representative Guerra, for your amendment, but it has failed to advance. Representative Gruenberg.
I'm going to offer another amendment.
Okay.
And that's an amendment to delete page lines 2 and 3 on page 2, the phrase, to protect the permanent fund from the effects of inflation and thereby assure that the real value of the permanent fund will be preserved over the long term. So it will start with the word appropriations. This was something that we talked a lot about in the Ways and Means Committee. We talked a lot about in the Ways and Means Committee. And I liked it at the time, but I have thought about it, and I think that we should delete it. And I have two reasons for saying that. One reason is that there may be other reasons why appropriations should not exceed 5%. The protection of the PFD, the permanent fund, from the effects of inflation may only be one reason. I'm going to give you another reason that's just as valid, and that is because the limitation on appropriations is a spending limit, and that in itself is another very good reason for having this here. So that's my first reason for wanting to delete it. The second reason is because, I'm going to give you three reasons. The second reason is because we had a lot of debate in Ways and Means on whether this is mandatory language or merely descriptive. And it caused a lot of legal discussion. And I think the less legal discussion we have in ambiguity in a constitutional provision, the better. And the third reason, independent reason, is because there are very few constitutional provisions that have descriptive language in them. And they asked this question of me, since Bruce Weirich had stepped out, I was the only lawyer around at the time. They asked me, is there any other place in the Constitution with descriptive language? And the only place I could think of was our right to bear arms amendment, where originally it said the well-regulated militia being necessary, et cetera, et cetera. And that caused a lot of problems with that amendment, and we had to amend it to assure a private right. So it really caused it didn't cause litigation in this state, caused litigation in another state, and caused us to have to amend the Constitution. And it's just much cleaner not to have that language in. And so for those three reasons, I would move to delete, and I'd ask unanimous consent.
I tend to agree. I want to hear what you guys are going to say. Yeah, that's what Representative Samuels. I tend to agree for the reasons Representative Grunberg stated and the reasons that Representative Ogg drew out. The only reason, like I said, that made any sense to me whatsoever was the political reason of presentment to the voters and how they would interpret that particular clause. When you start out with the negative or seemingly negative language saying that you cannot pay out or cannot exceed 5%, I wonder if a different interpretation is conjured up.
The courts typically look at the language in the voter pamphlet for that as legislative history, and that can easily be put in the voter pamphlet.
Yeah, and I'm not talking about the courts. I'm talking about the electorate.
Well, they'd see it in the voter pamphlet, too.
If they read it. Mr. Bartholomew.
Madam Chair, the discussion that took place going on in Ways and Means, and I was in conversations with our board members, the trustees at that time, and basically we felt that either version could work. They understand the concern, and so for purposes of the constitutional amendment, which will go into the voters' pamphlet, we would encourage the title to stay the same, which has some of the same words that are in subparagraph B, because this constitutional amendment, word for word, will go into the voter pamphlet. They won't see it.
I don't have a problem with that.
But that, so they were comfortable with that.
Representative Samuels.
Yeah, thank you. They were comfortable with the elimination of these two sentences. And I've got the D version, which Max and Representative Grunberg and Ogg and I heard in
It's the Ways and Means CS.
Yes. And the other version, it said something very similar, and then Ways and Means tweaked a little bit. But I'm just making sure that, speaking for the trustees, that you don't have any problem with the elimination.
Right. The D version was as submitted by the Board of Trustees, where it had that phrase broken into two specific sentences.
Yes.
And they had discussed that if that first sentence went away, you would end up with their amendment, and they that was their second preference, but they were they felt it was work that they could work with that.
For the record, Representative Holm has come back to us, and Representative Holm, just so that you know where we are working off of the Q version. We are on page 2, and we're looking at subsection B, and Representative Gruenberg has offered an amendment to strike the first portion of that sentence, starting with to protect and ending with long term, so that you begin the sentence now with appropriations from the permanent fund.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Sorry, I had a testimony in the other body's judiciary.
And so, Representative Samuels, do you maintain your objection?
No.
And so the objection has been removed. Is there any further objection?
I object.
Representative Gere objects. Do you want to speak to your objection or just object to object?
I do. We didn't let Representative Holm also know that nobody would let me constitutionalize the dividend. He missed that too.
There was that.
I caught that just as I walked in.
Well, that's six
it
to
went
one.
Down. 6-1? Well, it's been, no, you find
5-1.
Because I wasn't here. It would have been 6-1.
Well, I think I just got you on record.
Give me down.
Thanks. Actually, I understand the argument of the folks who want this out of the constitutional language. I like it. I think courts will often look at legislative intent. They'll look at constitutional intent. I think it's fine to have intent language in a statute or in the Constitution as long as it doesn't mess up the wording of the statute or Constitution. The mechanics of this provision will be that 5% of the value of the permanent fund can be spent. It's clear. So I don't see that the intent, the statement that we want to protect the permanent fund from inflation, harms this at all. I can't envision a circumstance where it would interfere with the operation of the constitutional amendment. And I think it is nice for the public to have an explanatory statement in the Constitution. I think we do that with our free speech clause. I think we do that with a number of other constitutional provisions where we have extra language that the courts use for intent purposes. But at a minimum, this, I think, helps the public also understand that that they have the right to have the permanent fund over the long term protected from inflation. So that's my objection.
This is a tough one for me. I agree with both sides. I mean, I think that the point is, you know, in Representative Gruenberg's amendment gets right at the goal of what we're trying to do. I think that he brings up a good argument that I think you could interpret it that if it weren't for the stated reason of protecting the fund from the effects of inflation and so on, if it were for another reason, that you might not be able to argue that the payment should exceed 5%. I don't know. I can see why they took 4 hours on it. I want this to succeed. I want it to succeed in its intent, and I want it to succeed with the electorate. And I think that's the points Representative Guerra is making is where I'm still stuck. I think I'll just vote to keep it in, I guess. So with that, does anybody else want to share their thoughts? Representative Holm?
No, I agree with you. I think that's good analysis. I was just wondering that if maybe possibly Representative Gruenberg was thinking mostly in terms of how cumbersome that the Constitution can possibly become if we had to give reasons. Yeah. And one of the things that I think that I kind of tend to want to agree with him is that over a period of time, the reasons that we are doing things today will vary for those who come after us. And so I don't know that I can understand why we might want to, for the sale of this, if you will, in the electorate, we might want to do this, but whether or not we want to put it into the Constitution has its question there. So I'm like you, I can probably argue both sides of this.
I'm going to take a brief Eddie's.
This would be one way that you could take funds out of the permanent fund in order to protect it, but we're not defining or prohibiting other ways to take funds out of the permanent fund, are we? How are you prohibiting any other manner in which to take them out? You're saying this is permissive here, permissive language of may. Appropriations may not exceed, so you could take them out to protect it for that. I'm just maybe playing devil's advocate. I don't want to leave a door open here. Perhaps something else comes up and you decide that you'd like to take it out. Are you prohibited from removing it from the permanent fund with the language that we have here?
Mr. Bartholomew and then Representative Grumer.
Chair, Representative Ogg, it's my understanding that there's no prohibition to taking money out of the permanent fund up to the level of 5%. So the constitutional amendment would say up to 5%, it's the power of appropriation that removes it, and there's no stipulation to why you would take it out or whether you could or couldn't. It's up to 5. It would prohibit you for any reason above. You could not go above that 5. That's a hard and fast limit.
Maybe I'm not being articulate enough, and that can happen sometimes, a lot of times. We're putting a clause in that says, for this particular purpose, you may take money out of the permanent fund, but it can't exceed 5%. That's what you do with the preamble clause in that thing. But let's just say you took paragraph B out. Can you take money out of the permanent fund?
If there'd be two answers to that. If you left subparagraph B out and took the word principal out, in other words, then you could spend the entire permanent fund. If you leave the word principal in, then you could spend the value of the permanent fund above principal. So it's so.
We've taken principal out.
We have not taken principal out. Oh, we've taken principal out of this proposal. That's correct. And we've replaced that with a 5% spending limit.
Right, but my question, if you remove Section B and Section A is in there the way it is there anything that limits you from taking money out of the permanent fund?
Through the chair, if not, no.
So then what I'm trying to drive at is if you say Section B, here is one way in which you can take it out, but the caveat to that is to protect the permanent fund, you could take money out. But
yes,
there's
right.
Nothing else that says you couldn't take it out in another fashion. Because you have this purpose, you're not limiting yourself to just that purpose.
Through the chair, Representative Ogg, it was pointed out to me that without subsection B, you couldn't take any money out of the permanent fund. Because the first part of the Constitution says it can be used for income-producing assets only. So if you took subparagraph B out, the permanent fund would grow forever.
Representative Samuels. Representative, on that point?
On that point, I was going to try to ask Representative Ogg's question a different way. If there were another way to protect the permanent fund from effects of inflation, or if you assumed that it was protected, I think that leads getting to the point where if we do not eliminate sentences or lines 2 and 3, that if it was protected, then you could take more than 5%. Is that...
If you achieve, yeah, I mean,
achieve the goal. If you achieve the goal,
that is
now I'm with you.
I think I am too. Representative Grunberg.
I think that it wouldn't be limited, but I don't know, and I don't want to cause litigation. Boy, we really don't want to.
I agree. Okay, I think enough said on that particular amendment. You maintain your objection. Representative Guerra, Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll on amendment number 2?
Representative Holm.
Yes.
Representative Samuels.
Yes.
Representative Guerra.
No.
Representative Grunberg.
Yes.
Representative Anderson has left the room. Representative Ogg.
Yes.
Representative McGuire.
Yes.
Passed 5-1.
Did that amendment just take out those two lines?
Yes.
2 and 3?
2 and 3 and capitalized A.
Capitalized A on appropriation.
And so, Representative Guerra, that amendment, yes. Page 2, the first portion of the sentence starting with to protect and ending with long term. So it will now simply state the phrase that begins with appropriations. Just get right to the activity. And so, Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move CS for HJR 26 as amended with individual recommendations.
And attached, zero fiscal notes. And so, is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, HJR 26 is moved. Pardon me. Thank you very much. Huh? Yes, will the chair be blessed? Please bless me.
Second.
So I found some constitutional language where...
Object!
Object.
Can I actually read this to you guys?
Dollar
order.
Sure.
Order.
We're going to take a brief at ease while we... Sure, he is called back to order. The time is 3:25. We're going to take up the Public Interest Litigants Bill, House Bill number 145. And we have Craig Tillery online with the Department of Law to present the bill to us. Mr. Tillery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When the committee last met on this bill, I did at that time present the bill. I provided my testimony, finished my testimony, and I believe at this point there were other people who wanted to testify, and I was prepared to answer questions.
That's right, Mr. Tillery. My apologies. Too many bills moving through. So with that, if you could just remain on the line for questions, and I will, I didn't close public testimony, and I will get to the folks that, as I remember, graciously passed over their testimony to the next time. So first up, I have Benjamin Brown, the Alaska State Chamber.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, I am Benjamin Brown, here on behalf of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, a membership organization of over 700 small, medium, and large businesses and 35 local chambers of commerce. And we strongly and wholeheartedly support House Bill 145, which will bring sanity and reason back to the public interest litigant doctrine. As you know, Madam Chairman, and as the committee members very likely know, Rule 82 is the provision, of the Alaska Rules of Civil Procedure that governs the award of attorney's fees in civil litigation. Probably more for the edification for anyone who's listening who's not as conversant as members of the Judiciary Committee are likely to be with the English rule in Alaska. Alaska is among a small minority of jurisdictions in the United States that actually has the English rule for attorney's fees. In most jurisdictions, it doesn't matter who wins or loses, you pay for your own attorneys. You can have costs awarded, but costs are often a lot less than attorney's fees in most lengthy and sizable civil litigation.
How many jurisdictions are there, Ben? I can't remember.
I think it's three. Please don't quote me on that, but it's a very small minority. And I think Alaska, coming late to the process of developing its judicial system, saw some wisdom in it.
Yep.
And I mentioned that as a preface to my comments on the public interest litigant doctrine as an exception to our version of the English rule. Our version of the English rule under Rule 82, which begins with the phrase except as otherwise provided by law or agreed to by the parties, gives a certain range of percentages from 1 to 20% in cases where there's a monetary judgment recovered. In cases where there's no monetary recovery, the range is between 20 and 30% that one party or the other can recover and of his or her attorney's fees. When we look at the kinds of cases that are often brought by public interest litigants, they are cases without monetary recovery because they're not brought for monetary damages. They're brought for declaratory judgments and injunctive relief, and usually with some sort of attempt to effectuate a public policy, and in many cases to prevent a permitted project or some other development from going forward. As I stated a moment ago, the rule begins with the phrase, except as otherwise provided by law. And the enabling statute for Rule 82 is the one that's being amended by Section 1 of the bill, Title 9, Section 60, Chapter 60, Section 10, cost and attorney fees allowed to a prevailing party. So I take it perforce as kind of beyond legal argument that any other provision of law in Section 10 can, without a court rule change, affect a change in Civil Rule 82. And the change that this bill seeks to effectuate is to narrow an exception to the public interest to the attorney fees rule called a public interest litigant doctrine, which has been articulated by the state Supreme Court in a number of cases, Citizens for Tort Reform versus McAlpine, Anchorage Daily News versus the Anchorage School District, and it comes up again and again. It's a four-part test, wherein the court will look at the nature of the, usually the plaintiff, who's the purported public interest litigant, and see if that party meets a pretty stringent test of A, B, C, and D, and on that basis determine whether or not to accord them public interest litigant status. If the party is so fortunate as to pass the court's four-part test, it can recover not 20 or 30%, but 100% of its attorney's fees if it prevails on even a single issue. And there was a case called Rewire the Board versus MEA, where the court struck down the doctrine of apportioning prevailing parties, the extent to which they prevail. And if they prevailed on a few issues, the court said, well, then they prevailed overall, and if they're a public interest litigant, they can get the whole shebang back. So it's really a very strong exception to Rule 82 that the court has crafted here. The state chamber doesn't want to get rid of the public interest litigant doctrine. The state chamber supports the Rules Committee and the governor's office approach set out in House Bill 145 in a very, very limited number of actions. Those that appeal an administrative agency decision from the Department of Environmental Conservation, the Department of Fish and Game, or the Department of Natural Resources, in which one of those three departments has made a coastal consistency determination, adopted regulations, or made an administrative law decision and allowed for an opportunity for that decision to be reviewed under the normal processes of administrative law. In those contexts, when it's that kind of an action with the state as a defendant, it's, I think, wise not to allow the court's, the Supreme Court's exceptional public interest litigant doctrine to skew the scales and not restrict the potential recovery to 20 to 30% or impose liability for the plaintiff's cost on the defendant, the state. You know, and the reason for that is this. This will just make the court have to return to the stated language of Rule 82 if it really feels that there are exceptional circumstances that justify an award of greater than 30%. If you look at Rule 82B3, there are a number of exceptions within Rule 82 that can achieve the same purposes as the public interest litigant doctrine. The court, if I may quote, Madam Chairman, the court may vary an attorney's fee award calculated under subparagraph B1 or B2 of this rule upon consideration of the factors listed below, and if the court determines that a variation is warranted. And those factors include the complexity of litigation, the length of the trial, the reasonableness of the attorney's hourly fees, the reasonableness of the number of attorneys used, the attorney's efforts to minimize fees. I think this next one's quite important. The reasonableness of the claims and defenses pursued by each side, vexatious or bad faith conduct, the relationship between the amount of work performed and the significance of the matters at stake. Again, this one is quite germane to public interest litigants. The extent to which a given fee award may be so onerous to the non-prevailing party that it would deter similarly situated litigants from the voluntary use of the courts. J is important, and then K is a catch-all. Other equitable factors deemed relevant. If a court varies an award, the court shall explain the reasons for the variation. I submit to you, Madam Chairman, and the members of the Judiciary Committee, when House Bill 140.